Wired Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin college students are looking underground for new antibiotics. We'll find out what they're digging up. First, it's that time of year when we see lots of best of lists, especially when it comes to things like music, best albums, best songs, or if you're a Spotify user, a list of the songs most played by you. But back in September, Rolling Stone magazine took on a much bigger challenge. They released a list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. The last time they did that was 2003. Here's an idea of the range of selected albums. Number 300, Shania Twain's Come On Over, 1997. Number 244, Kanye West, 808s and Heartbreak from 2008. 149, John Prine, 1971. Number 144, Led Zeppelin, Physical Graffiti from 1975. A few of the bands that made it onto the top 50 include Outkast, Bob Marley, The Ramones, Paul Simon, Prince, The Rolling Stones, Beyonce, The Beatles, Kendrick Lamar, and Nirvana. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite album? Or what do you think is the best album of all time? Or a favorite few, maybe? What makes them stand out to you? If you can't pick a favorite, tell us one you've been going back to listen to this year. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Evan Rutleski is a writer and web editor for 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. His music and pop culture writing has appeared in Pitchfork, the AV Club, American Songwriter, and Paste Magazine. He was a part of the Rolling Stone selection process. Evan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be here, Rob.
Before we get into specific albums, Evan, I got to ask about your process, because if somebody asked me to pick the best album, I would think, does that mean, you know, the one I enjoyed the most, or the one I appreciate as an achievement, or the one that stood the test of time? How did you try to define best albums when you voted?
Yeah, what was cool about this process is the ballots were secret. So I think if you're making a public facing list, you feel that obligation to get all your favorites in there and make sure it's representative and make sure you're not embarrassing yourselves. But what Rolling Stone did with this list is they reached out to people that they wanted to include, be they a lot of them were celebrities or musicians, you know, Beyonce and Taylor Swift and Billie Eilish, famous people. And then a lot of people like me, just critics you probably never heard of, who cast a ballot. And they said, we want this to represent a lot of different viewpoints. Don't feel obligated to include albums just because you think they should be included. Vote for what you want. Vote for what you like. We want your tastes. So what I did for my ballot was I just really, as much as I could off the top of my head, just came up with 50 albums that sort of came to mind and sent them over.
And the list that Rolling Stone ended up with is pretty amazing. I remember as a kid looking at their list, and it was always, you know, this Beatles album, that Rolling Stones, that Van Morrison, that Dylan, that The Band, and so on. And those are still there. But there's some jazz. There's lots of hip hop and rap. There's some metal. There's pop. There's a huge mix here. It's a lovely mess in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yeah. So that was sort of the big takeaway, is Rolling Stone has made these lists over the decades. And, you know, every few years they update them, every decade or two they update them. But it usually looks pretty samey. And it usually sort of emphasizes those core artists you remember seeing on the cover of Rolling Stone. And in particular, a lot of white males. That's sort of kind of the backbone of rock music, at least American and British rock music. And white males have always been overrepresented on these lists. This list was sort of the first time you look at it and it really like pops with diversity. There's a lot more women, a lot more artists of color. There's three times as many rap albums on there. It's not just a token rap album every dozen picks or so. Now it's lots of rap. It's a lot more representative than it was before.
I'm sure people are very curious about the number one pick. I want to end the suspense now and give a listen to a clip from the number one album on the Rolling Stone list. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. So it's Marvin Gaye, that's What's Going On, the album released in 1971. What do you think about this ending up as the pick, the number one album on this list?
I think it's a great pick. I mean, it's an album everybody can agree on. Everybody likes this album if you've heard it. And it's not like it came from nowhere. This is an album that's been, you know, usually in the top 10 on previous Rolling Stone lists. So it's not like they took some album randomly and elevated it with a big promotion that came out of the blue, they just kind of re-ranked it a little bit. And I think it's a good pick. It speaks to the moment. I don't think that's lost on anybody that this is sort of an album about social strife at a time when there's a lot of social strife. So the album feels more relevant than maybe it did at various points in the past. But that's what's great about a classic album is it holds up, that 20 years from now, it might mean something different than it does right now.
We got an email from Pete in Reedsburg who says, if Dark Side of the Moon is not in the top five, then the list is dead to me. Well, Pete, the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon is on the top 500. I don't remember exactly where, not in the top five, but I think, Evan, part of the fun of lists like this is as a conversation starter, maybe a debate starter.
Yeah, so, you know, some of these lists you can tell from other sites sometimes or other publications, you can tell they're trolling a little bit with what they leave off or what they don't rank. I really feel like Rolling Stone, just by virtue of being Rolling Stone and being such a huge list, I mean, there are 500 albums on this list. They tried to cover as much as they could. If you like a certain style of music, it's on there. If you like one of the mainstay legacy bands, like a Pink Floyd, they're certainly on there. There's plenty of Pink Floyd albums on the list. I'm not sure where Dark Side of the Moon is on the list off the top of my head, but I know it's up there. It's Dark Side right. of the Moon. You know, the classics are still the classics, as they would say.
Well, it's interesting. You can say, okay, how does Dark Side compare with The Wall? Or how do Pink Floyd albums compare with Led Zeppelin? Here you can say, like, how does Dark Side of the Moon compare with Beyonce or John Coltrane or Miles Davis? Like, these are kind of zany arguments to try to have when it comes to the relative ranking from these all these different genres, isn't it?
I think what really throws people off is the newness. You know, we're so used to seeing the classic albums from the 60s or 70s on these lists because we've been seeing them on these lists for decades. It's where you start getting into albums from the last 5 or 10 years that it starts to feel a little thornier and that people get way more worked up. So you had a Lana Del Rey album on there that ranked pretty high. That's going to stir some debate because people are going to think, all right, does a 2019 Lana Del Rey album, will it stand the test of time the same way Stevie Wonder and John Coltrane have? Or I think the one that was maybe most controversial is you had a new Harry Styles album on there. That's going to tick a lot of people off. But again, you know, it's any ranking is, it reflects the moment. It captures the moment and the music that's valued at this particular point in time. I think if you look at this list and say, in 2035, are we going to feel that this Harry Styles album was ranked accurately? I think the answer is no, right? I mean, canons change over time. Tastes and preferences and music that we value, music that's deemed influential, it changes over time.
Talking to Evan Rutleski from 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. He voted in the Rolling Stone selection process for the top 500 albums of all time. Well, speaking of more recent material, I mentioned Beyonce. Her album Lemonade ended up on the list. Here's a listen to Sorry. Evan, this was kind of an epic release back in 2016. One of the newer albums you mentioned on this album. Not a surprise to see it on the list, though, is it?
Yeah, it's not going to be controversial for most people. You know, Beyonce was one of, obviously, she's one of the biggest artists of the last two decades. And she's one of those artists who sort of showed that pop music can be political and personal and silly and irreverent at the same time, that you can do it all. And I think, you know, when this album came out, it came out to instant acclaim. And 4 or 5 years later, it still sounds like a really important album. So yeah, Beyonce is all over the list. I think Beyonce really, I mean, deserves all the accolades she gets. She was really one of those artists who taught critics to think different about the genres that they prioritize.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with a disclaimer. We won't be able to instantly say what number some of these albums are in at. The list is comprehensive. It is not quickly searchable. Anne joins us now in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. So in 1970, Black Sabbath put out an album called Paranoid. And in 1973, almost 50 years ago, I was like 15 years old, and we listened to that over and over. And to be honest, it was the only time that I ever dropped acid, and Iron Man was the best song to listen to.
And thanks a lot for the call. Black Sabbath Paranoid is on the list, and I'll say 10 years later, the smoking kids on the bus stop were still listening to Paranoid. It is an album that stuck around long enough to make the list, Evan.
That's fantastic. I mean, again, totally holds up. Total classic. People love it, and most of those are represented on the list.
Thanks a lot for that call. And let's go to Patrick now in Juneau. Patrick, hi.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Good. What album do you want to nominate, Patrick?
Oh, I want to nominate Bat Out of Hell.
By Meatloaf. Yes. Favorite song on that one, Patrick?
Baby, You Can Talk All Night.
All right. Patrick, thanks a lot for the suggestion. I didn't see that, I don't think, on the list. But that's the fun part of this, Evan. Everybody's got the album that means something special to them.
I think it's got to be on the list somewhere. Again, it's 500 albums. During a break or something, I'm going to search for my own gratification. But I love Meatloaf. I saw him at Summerfest maybe 5 or 10 years ago, and it was such like a ridiculous, theatrical, over-the-top show. And I was like, man, this guy gets it. This is just fun.
Thank you so much for that call, Patrick. I appreciate it. We are talking with Evan Rutlesky, writer and web editor at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee, looking at Rolling Stone's picks for the top 500 albums of all time. Evan contributed his slate of 50 to that. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What album or albums make your top list? What makes an album special? Not just as a collection of songs, maybe, but as, you know, a comprehensive whole. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Evan Rutlesky, music writer, web editor for 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. He was part of the top 500 albums of all time selection process for Rolling Stone magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your number one album of all time? Whatever that means to you, your favorite, the best thing you've ever heard, something that stood the test of time. 800-642-1234 is the number. Ethan joins us next in Janesville. Ethan, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's your album, Ethan?
I wanted to nominate D-Lost in the Comatorium by the Mars Volta. I got turned on to that band by the Rolling Stone when they did 100 Greatest Guitar Solos. That was in there. These guys are just monsters in the progressive rock scene. They really revamped the whole scene in that regard, and they were fairly well received critically.
Ethan, thanks a lot for sharing that one with us. And I imagine, Evan, as I go through the list, you know, there's a lot that's like, oh, I like this one, I like that one, I remember that. But a lot of, oh, I should check this one out, which is what started Ethan on Mars Volta. Are you getting that looking through the overall list, ones that you want to take a closer look at?
From this list, not really, because I've heard of most of these albums. That's the thing.
What's
you know,
your
these
job,
are the
I guess?
You sort of grew up, your parents gave you, and, you know, I was born into knowing these albums were great. But I love that comment because what Ethan just said, it speaks to how important these lists can be. You know, I have discovered plenty of great elder, artists and albums from lists like this. And growing up, I used to read this Rolling Stone list, and it was like, you know, to me, it seemed like gospel when I was a kid. I would go through those books of these albums, and what the critics said in Rolling Stone meant a lot. At the time, it felt like the final word on what these albums meant.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's give a listen to another one on the final list that I understand was on your list, Evan. This is Rihanna.
You never could imagine. Never thought you could have it. You need me. Ooh, you need me.
So Needed Me from Rihanna's album Anti from 2016. Evan, why did this one make your list and the overall list?
Yeah, I never considered myself a huge Rihanna fan. I always kind of respected her as a pop star and an artist with some great singles. But for me, this Anti album, this is when she just leveled up in such a big way. It was such a creative record. The production was so interesting. Her vocals were so bold and expressive and fierce. The angles of attack she took for every song, I was just stunned by just how virtuosic the whole thing was. And I think it's a cool pick to see on there, because this is the kind of album that might not have made the cut for Rolling Stone lists like this in the past. It's from a younger artist, from an artist of color, an artist who might get dismissed as a pop star, not like a quote unquote serious artist. So seeing that she got that consideration, see that she can rank right in the middle of a list like this, right alongside the Dylans and the Beatles and everything, I just thought was so cool. It shows how much this list has grown over the decades.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rick is with us in Coleman. Rick, hi.
Hi there, sir. How are you?
Good. What album do you want to share, Rick?
Well, I think the greatest album of all time is Queen's Greatest Hits 2. It just came out a few months ago that Queen is the most listened to songs every day. 20 million listeners.
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Queen is on the list. I don't know if the Greatest Hits album is, Evan, but that brings up an interesting point. Albums versus Greatest Hits compilation. I think there was at least a Madonna Greatest Hits compilation on the list. What do you think of that question, like a freestanding album versus a compilation?
Yeah, there's two answers. You can be a purist and say, well, the album is the real statement or the real document. But if I'm being honest, one of my favorite albums ever is Al Green's Greatest Hits. Yeah, Al Green's records individually are amazing. He had like 8 classic records in the 70s. But if you pick up that Greatest Hits, it's just like an hour of the best music ever recorded start to back. So I'll never knock a Greatest Hits album.
Thanks a lot for that call. John joins us next in Elkhorn. John, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
So I'm curious because I haven't followed the lists over, when did you say the last one was put out?
2003, I want to say. Yeah, 2003.
2003. So what would we say has changed over between the top 10 of before and now? I'm going to comment that I know that from what I've heard is that the Beatles album that used to be regularly near the top would be Sgt. Pepper, and that's slipped, mightily in the last few polls. But, you know, when you take an album like that, and for many of us, we know that album forwards and backwards, and then you try to compare it and I love Marvin Gaye. He was a wonderful artist, and I realize how important What's Going On is. But not many people are going to know that album as they do some of the other ones, including Sgt. Pepper. And I'm just going to say that somewhere along the line, Rolling Stone has missed the mark on this list a little bit, especially within the upper echelon.
Gotcha. John, thanks a lot for the call. And just looking at the list, yeah, Sgt. Pepper drops from 1 to 24, but 2 other Beatles albums beat Sgt. Pepper now, Abbey Road and Revolver, and Marvin Gaye went from 6 to number 1. But he's concerned, I think, Evan, about that rethinking and that shuffling at the top.
Yeah, so, I mean, nobody's saying that Sgt. Pepper is a bad album. It's still in the top 25. That's incredible. Top 25 of all albums ever recorded. Still a remarkable feat, still a ton of Beatles albums on there. And by shaving a little bit of the extra albums off from some of these legacy acts that were maybe overrepresented on previous lists, you've made a lot of room for other albums. So did we need 11 Bob Dylan albums on there, or is it okay just to have 8? You know, and especially if shaving 3 Dylan albums off there creates room for D'Angelo and stuff that maybe people haven't heard yet or haven't given the chance yet. And I think what's interesting is, you know, when you see a list like this and it says at the top, number 1 is the Beatles album that you've known your whole life, you go, eh, that's interesting. But if number 1 is a Marvin Gaye album that maybe you've never listened to start to finish, I think you're more likely to check it out. I think there's a little bit more value in a list like this when it does challenge you to check out something that maybe is just a little unfamiliar.
John, thanks a lot for calling in. Chrissy joins us next in Green Bay. Chrissy, hello.
Hi.
Hi. What albums do you want to share with us, Chrissy?
Well, I feel bad because we're just talking about Bob Dylan, but Bob Dylan, Oh Mercy, and Pearl Jam 10. Pearl Jam 10 is, like, iconic.
Thanks a lot for that call. I don't think anybody's judging you negatively for putting a Bob Dylan album in there. There are eight, you said, I think, Evan, in the new list?
Yeah, something like that. And Bob Dylan is in the top 10. Blood on the Tracks is at number 9. And then there's Highway 61 Revisited at number 18. So again, lots of love for Dylan. In fact, I think he's got the most albums of anybody still, or if nothing else, he's right up there. And those albums have aged beautifully. You know, it's hard to imagine a time where Dylan albums won't be right up near the top of a list like this.
And then she also mentioned Pearl Jam 10. I believe that's on there. I don't have the scrolling in front of me, but Pearl Jam, talk about them a little.
You know, it really should be up there. I don't know if it's in the top 100, but I certainly know it's got to be somewhere on that list. And I think that's another band that has aged really, really well. You know, when you look at 90s rock, there's maybe a little bit less of it on the list than you might think, especially if you were of the age where you grew up with 90s rock. Nirvana's Nevermind, of course, is the biggest of that era. It's number 6 on the list. But Pearl Jam's 10 was right up there for a lot of people. Lots of hits, an album that's aged really well, and also a band that's really retained its fan base really well. You know, that's a band that is still playing huge arena shows, even though they're not, you know, front and center in the public's mind, maybe the way a band like Foo Fighters would be. Foo Fighters sort of up there commercially all the time. Pearl Jam, you know, maybe they don't have new hits like they used to, but they still have that following. They still matter.
Chrissy, thanks a lot for that call. Coming up after the news, we'll continue with our guest, Evan Rutleski, music writer, web editor for 88.9 Radio Milwaukee, and he's a contributor to the top 500 albums of all time selection by Rolling Stone magazine. Time for more of your calls, by the way, at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the best albums of all time. Rolling Stone magazine recently released their picks of the 500 best with surveys of performers, writers, and more. You can find a link to the list at WPR.org/Central Time. We're hearing one of the selections here right now, So What by Miles Davis from his album Kind of Blue from 1959, number 31 on the list. Evan Rutleski is with us, writer and web editor for 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. He contributed to the list, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. We've got Joe on the line in Bayview. Joe, hello.
Hey there. How are you doing?
Good. What's your nomination?
Well, this might not be on the list, but I'm sitting here flipping through my records, and I had to pull out Apostrophe by Frank Zappa.
Are you a hardcore Zappa fan, Joe? Because I know some people, like the guitarist in my band, if you like Zappa, you like Zappa.
Yeah, I am. You know what? I grew up listening to him because of my dad and my uncles, and it kind of just rubbed off. He's my guy, and I had to call in.
Joe, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, I don't think I saw Zappa on the list, but I didn't dig quite to the end, I don't think. Do you remember if we made it? And just thoughts on why or why not he might not appear on there.
I have no idea, but there is such a diehard Zappa fan base. I've got to imagine out of 500 albums, he squeaked in there at least once. I wish I could talk with Joe off air because I just don't get Zappa. I just never spoke to me. Maybe it's something you have to kind of inherit. I know a lot of people who like Zappa are into Zappa because their dad was into Zappa. That just wasn't the case for me, but I would love to check it out sometime and try to figure out what the appeal is because I've never gotten it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Jason now in Kennan. Jason, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction.
Okay, what is, I mean, that's a big one. It's on the list, number 62, I happen to know. What makes that one stick out for you, though?
Every song was good on that album.
All right, pretty straightforward. Well, we've got one of them actually queued up. We kind of pulled a random sample. Here's Guns N' Roses, a little Welcome to the Jungle. Do we have that? Let's give a listen. We don't have it. Okay. Guns N' Roses, though, stuck around with a lot of people, I think, for a long time and did pretty well on the list, that album, Evan.
It really holds up. You know, when you look at like 80s hard rock albums, they're not as highly ranked on this list as they used to be. I think that's one genre that sort of took a hit. Not all the albums from that era have aged particularly well. This one has. Just like the caller said, it's a perfect rock album. Every song is titanic. I'm not sure any record captured this ideal as perfectly as Guns N' Roses did.
Thanks a lot for the suggestion. Sorry, I could do my Axl Rose impersonation. Yeah, I'll save that for another time, though. Let's let's go to Steve next with us in Green Bay. Steve, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to share, Steve? What albums are on your list?
Oh, well, you know, growing up in the 70s and earlier than that, listening to AM radio down in Chicago, pulling that in over the air, one of my favorite albums in high school was REO Speedwagon. You can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish. And just every song on there was just rock and roll before REO kind of turned pop.
Uh-huh. And you had another one for us, I think, Steve.
Yeah, also Fleetwood Mac Rumors, an excellent album, great artistry on that, and just in my mind, a classic. Every song is a great song.
This one we do have a clip for, a little Fleetwood Mac here. This one, Evan, the number 7 album, Fleetwood Mac Rumors, that's Dreams, a new generation introduced by one of the most popular TikTok videos of a guy on his longboard lip-syncing with Stevie Nicks there. That one has held up, hasn't it?
You know, the classics are still the classics. Like they said, if a record was that big, it's always going to be big. It's always going to have a place in the canon. And it is amazing. I mean, the record obviously has aged like fine wine. But it's cool that it speaks to a new generation of younger listeners. That's something I think that distinguishes it from the records that maybe fell far down the list. Some records sort of, you know, age out with their generation and others just sort of stand the test.
Great suggestions there. Bob joins us next in Amherst. Bob, hello.
Yeah, hi.
What is your album, Bob?
Dave Brubeck, Take 5.
Oh, yeah, Take 5, Blue Rondo a la Turk, Unsquare Dance, a lot of great off-kilter songs on that one. That's one you still listen to, Bob?
Oh, yes.
Bob, thank you for sharing that. Evan, I'll take you behind the scenes to the old days of public radio. We all kind of winced when we hear that album because here on the Ideas Network, that was, if everything went wrong technologically, that was the album you put in. So if we were listening at home or on the road and we heard Dave Brubeck on the network, we knew it was the sound of doom on the radio. That said,
I would
pretty
be
good album.
Because I love that album so much. It is perfect. I probably listened to it more than any other jazz album. Once when I was voting for a different list, Pitchfork's Best Albums of the 60s, I was trying so hard for them to accept this album, which was released in like December 1959. So technically it wasn't released in the 60s, but I was still going to say, I mean, its influence was so enormous, the way it shaped jazz. And it felt like the 60s, even though it was technically released in the 50s. Just an incredible record. If you own 3 jazz records, make this one of them. You cannot go wrong. It is so good.
Well, Bob, you got a lot of stories out of that one. Thank you so much for sharing that. We're talking about the Rolling Stone magazine 500 Best Albums of All Time list out this year. Evan Rutleski with us from 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. Back to your calls. Chris is on the line in Iron River. Chris, hi.
Billy Squire.
Okay, remind me which songs. Is that Everybody Wants You? Was that on that one?
Yep, yes, sir.
Okay, and why is that one that stuck with you so much, Chris? I don't think it made it to the list.
Like we've heard time and time again, it just every song on the album was just excellent, and you know, he kind of carried kind of the same theme through the whole album.
Cool. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that one. Evan, every song, and we've heard this from a few listeners now, where they just think back on an album and every song stands out to them. Do you have an album like that for you, Evan?
I mean, I've got dozens. Yeah. For me, you know, one of my favorites, it's just whatever you're listening to at the time. Right now, for me, one of my favorites is REM's Murmur, their debut. That was a record I grew up with as a kid, and it meant something to me then when I was listening to it, but I've kind of rediscovered it in the last couple years, and I'm just like, wow, this is an album that feels bigger than the sum of its parts. You just get kind of sucked into it, and that's what you're looking for. You're looking for that spark of magic.
Thanks a lot for the call. Chris joins us next in La Crosse. Chris, hi.
Hi. My vote is for Peter Frampton. Peter Frampton Comes Alive.
A big live album. And yeah, Chris, that's one for me when I hear Do You Feel Like We Do? And I'm in the car. I'm like, great. I'm set for 8-10 minutes now. Is this a good car one for you?
Yeah, it's excellent. The whole album is just excellent. The power and just the feel of the live album, the way he gets the crowd involved, it's just excellent.
Chris, thanks for the call. And the live album, Evan. I know the Who Live at Leeds is one I saw on there. What do you think of live albums and their place on lists like this?
I totally have a spot. You know, Johnny Cash, live at Folsom Prison.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes they can just capture something the studio can't. And I think that Frampton album is a good example. I'm not sure you would put a Frampton studio album on a list like this because, frankly, I just don't know if they're quite good enough. But Frampton Comes Alive, that was the one moment where he just connected.
Thanks for that call. Time for another caller or two. Larry is on the line in Kingston. Larry, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. T for the Tillerman. Greatest album. Every song is good. I especially like Morning Has Broken. They even sing that in church.
Cat Stevens. Thanks a lot. I know I saw Cat Stevens on the list somewhere, and I think it was that album, Evan.
I think that's his best regarded. You know, without having the numbers, that could be an artist whose ranking has fallen a little bit. I think when Rolling Stone last did this list, singer-songwriters like Cat Stevens tended to place a little better. You know, there used to be 3 Nick Drake albums on the list. Now there's only 1. But these things are cyclical. You know, next time Rolling Stone updates this list, could be back up there again.
Time for one more caller. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hello.
Hi. Radiohead, OK Computer, and I would say life-changing.
Thank you, Louise. That would be, if somebody made me make a list, that would definitely be on it. It is in the top 50, and I think Kid A by Radiohead is ahead of it, Evan. Radiohead at least has a few on the list, I think.
Yeah, Radiohead is all over this list, and deservedly so. You know, I think for a lot of people, they represent like the ideal of serious artistry in rock music. They push the boundaries. Their records make big statements. They just sound cool. They've aged really well. OK Computer's at number 42 on this list, and deservedly so.
Thanks a lot for that call, Louise. And Evan, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Always so much fun. Thank you.
Evan Rutleski is a writer and web editor for 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. He was part of the top 500 albums of all time selection process, that list published earlier this year by Rolling Stone. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, a UW Green Bay professor tells us about a course that has students digging in the dirt to discover new antibiotics as the struggle against antibiotic-resistant bacteria continues. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a weekly look at personal finance with a focus this week on end-of-year financial planning. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now we may think about the ground beneath us as a source of a lot of things, nutrients for plants, trees, and fungi, groundwater, but how about the source for new antibiotics? A course at UW Green Bay brings students together with their peers from around the country and around the world to help discover new antibiotics that can replace older versions that germs have already become immune to. Brian Merkel is a professor of biology at UW Green Bay, where he teaches courses on immunology, microbiology, and human diseases and society. One course in particular being taught in many locations called Tiny Earth, where students look to different patches of soil for new antibiotic answers. He's been participating this week in a two-day symposium where students share their findings from the course. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's great to be with you.
Let's first talk about the problem before we get into this class. How big of an issue is antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
It's a leading world crisis, and one of the things that is a terrific concern is that it's only intensifying, and we are in the middle of a pandemic. And one of the things I think that goes unnoticed, not talked enough about, is that pandemics like COVID-19 will only make this more severe, this world crisis of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, because a lot of often what happens in patients that are infected with COVID, they're put on different types of antibiotics as a prevention to becoming infected as a secondary infection with certain types of bacteria, which give the bacteria that humans carry another opportunity to develop drug resistance.
Right. And that's a good point to raise. COVID-19, a virus, antibiotics don't help with, but it raises our vulnerability, and many other things raise our vulnerability to bacterial infections along the way, right?
Absolutely. So we have been before COVID-19 already getting to a point where nothing on the shelf works for bacterial infections. And I do appreciate you separating antibiotics, which are used to treat bacterial infections. They are not used to treat infections caused by viruses. And historically, those blurred lines have led to the rise of more antibiotic-resistant bacteria because there's a lot of reasons for this. Patients expecting to feel better very quickly when they see a physician, they report having an upper respiratory infection, and demands are put. There's a lot of pressure even put on physicians to give them prescriptions for antibiotics that won't help them because invariably many of these infections are caused by viruses.
Now, here we have this Tiny Earth program and a course that you're working with at UW-Green Bay. What are your students doing to try to discover new candidates to become the antibiotics of the future?
Well, I think really what the Tiny Earth Initiative is about is the recognition of this trove, this wealth of antibiotic-producing bacteria that exist in the soil. Pharmaceutical companies have abandoned this effort for a lot of interesting reasons. But one of the things that we know is that there are we have this trove of bacteria in the soil. And so at this point, this Tiny Earth Initiative, which is international, includes and involves the help of students around the world. And it's in excess of 10,000 students around the world that are digging for gold, essentially. And the more of us that look, the greater the chance that we are going to find antibiotics to help us address this worldwide problem.
If I'm a student in one of these Tiny Earth programs around the world, I'm literally digging, right? I'm getting my hands dirty in this class.
Yeah, you are. So essentially, students get to, generally how this works is that they get to pick a spot of interest. They collect data, but it always starts with a small sample of soil. It doesn't take much. And then over a 14-week class like we have at UW-Green Bay, they are the researchers. They're doing the work. And one of the things that Tiny Earth does very well in that vein is that it really gets students interested in science. We know that interest in STEM career science, for example, we've got some challenges. We'd like to think that we can do that better. So certainly my experience in doing this at UW-Green Bay for a number of years now, the course gets full very quickly. There's a lot of excitement about it. So number one, it does that. I think it keeps students interested in science. It inspires them to continue on. And at the same time, it's addressing this world crisis of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Talking to Brian Merkel, biology professor at UW-Green Bay, about a program bringing students together from campuses around the world to literally dig in the dirt to try to find antibiotics of the future. And Brian, I look at a patch of soil and maybe don't think much of it. It's just some dirt. But to quote Tom Waits, there's a world going on underground. Can you tell us how much life is in that small patch of soil that your students are working with?
there's a tremendous amount of diversity. And interestingly enough, we're really only tapping into what that diversity is, because historically part of the problem, whether it's a pharmaceutical company or other groups that have looked at this or have done this, is that we've recognized for some time that we are not and have not been able to cultivate and culture all that is there. So I think the techniques are getting better for doing just that, identifying and developing these bacteria. We look at the kinds of antibiotics that they're producing. I think the other thing we're getting better at these days as scientists is coming up with ways to jumpstart these bacteria to produce the antibiotics that we're desperately looking for. Historically, that's been a challenge too. And so that's something else we're getting very good at. And I would also say the Tiny Earth approach is getting very, very good at screening out those bacteria that are producing antibiotics we already know of, right? The streptomycins of the world, the tetracyclines of the world. So many of the world's antibiotics are produced. They are naturally made by molds and by bacteria. And so one of the things that the Tiny Earth group is very good at doing these days is screening out some of the ones that we already know of. And that has been a challenge historically, and Tiny Earth is getting very good at doing that as well.
Now, you had this symposium this week. What kind of things did you hear from people who had participated in this?
Just that. So what we heard about are all the creative ways that students working with their Tiny Earth partner instructors around the world coming up with creative approaches to getting their soil isolates, their soil bacteria to produce antibiotics, looking at these bacteria in the presence of other bacteria, right? It makes sense that you would imagine realizing that the reason why soil bacteria produce antibiotics is because they're trying to ward off competition in their soil environments, getting rid of other competitors in their environments. So one of the really great things that we heard about over the course of the symposium is how different investigators are coming up with different ways to get their soil bacteria to produce antibiotics, which includes introducing a community or a partner organism to get them to do that, to try to mirror what they really face in the soil environment.
As we wrap up, Brian, are you hopeful that this kind of hands-on soil research is going to lead to the development of usable antibiotics in the near to medium term future?
It has. And I will tell you that given the fact that, here's the thing, this program is now in 27 countries. And it's just getting started. It's in 47 states in this country, and it's only going to continue to grow. What I heard about today, the Tiny Earth Group, which is housed on the UW-Madison campus with their chemistry hub and everything that they're doing, they take these soil isolates that student researchers around the world supply them for further characterization. And they have fine-tuned their techniques tremendously, even over the past 3 years. And I would expect, given what I heard today, that there's very real hope that we're going to learn about significant breakthroughs in this area in the next couple of years. Absolutely.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Brian Merkel, professor of biology at UW Green Bay, talking about the Tiny Earth course going out on campuses around the world. Tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics with the aftermath of the Electoral College vote. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. There were two big stories in the Wisconsin sports world today, with one superstar sticking around for the future and one that may have the power to go back to the future. Part one, you may have felt a positive disturbance in the force today when Giannis Antetokounmpo announced that he's staying with the Milwaukee Bucks, signing a 5-year extension on his contract for lots of money. Apparently, fans of other pro basketball teams have been photoshopping their jerseys onto the Bucks star, hoping he'd come to their team. Now, sour grapes are all that remains for them. Part two, Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers is having another ridiculously good season, but he may have powers even beyond the football field, including the ability to travel through time. As reported in the Green Bay Press Gazette, an auction of a photo on eBay caught the sports world's attention. The black and white photo is from the late 1800s or early 1900s. It shows what appear to be a wife and husband, and the guy looks a lot like Aaron Rodgers, like a lot. Even his era-appropriate mustache looks like something that Rodgers might wear today, which raises the question, is this why Rodgers throws so few interceptions? When he makes a mistake, he just travels back in time to warn himself about the coverage? Quarterback to the future. This is Central Time.